Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. Today we have a very special guest.
Yeah.
For many reasons, which I will allow Dr. Alma to get into.
So our guest on today's episode of the Cheeky Natives, which is a live recording, is Mohale Mashego. Mohale Mashego is very special to the Cheeky Natives for a number of reasons. Post her launch of The Yearning at Bridge Books in town, we had such an amazing time and we fangirled so much that we decided to start a podcast.
But I think what we need to talk about is how we stalked her and basically forced her to come onto the Cheeky Natives when we were on Twitter. So post reading The Yearning, we basically had a 2-hour conversation
and we were like,
and now you have my personal number, so you harass me even more.
I had to tag her on stuff after reading The Yearning also, because then I had like forced everybody around me to buy The Yearning, and people were like, if you're gonna make us buy this book, you better talk to this author. And I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, I need to make the points.
You guys made it a bestseller. Bonang said your power influenza.
And it's also been reprinted and
a million times.
It is now shortlisted.
It was shortlisted.
Like, I'm even losing track.
My sister, so before we get into your sophomore collection of short stories, we want to talk about post The Yearning, right? So you wrote this really incredible story about Marubeni. You know, I still quote the start of The Yearning to people every time I meet them. I'm like, if you want to read a book, just read the first line. You know, my mother died 7 times before she gave birth to me. I'm grateful for the corpse that always seemed to resurrect itself. I really, from
there on, and you low-key judge people who say they're into South African books and haven't read The Yearning.
Like, that's true.
Low-key judge them, but high-key tell them.
No judgment. It's so, a bestseller. They'll get around to it.
So we want to know, like
sooner, better, rather than later. Also, did you hear that Loki humble brag?
It's a bestseller.
That's a fee.
So we want to know, like, what does life look like post The Yearning, obviously, and winning the debut prize for the UJ prize? How has that been for you, for your confidence as a writer?
Well, firstly, and someone from the publishers here, so maybe she knows, but the day we went to print, I sent a very long, weepy email saying, look, I don't think the book is that good. Can you please give me another 10 years to write? And I promise you it'll be perfect. And my publisher, Andrea, said, I get this all the time from authors. And I'm sorry to tell you, but it's being printed now as we are speaking. You're going to be okay. You're not getting another 10 years. And I was really worried, because then I went to Franschhoek Literary Festival and literally it was all like old ladies sitting there. And I was talking about this book and I said to them, it's imposter syndrome, but I feel like I'm making you guys buy a rubbish book. And I do apologize in advance. But then it was sold out. I forgot to tell you, it was sold out. Even after I told the people it's a rubbish book. So it's just been weird. I feel like Mohale Mashego, that's not even my real name. So Mohale Mashego has kind of taken over my life.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to make music. And I feel like I created a monster, honestly. The other day at the airport, I'm tired, it's at night, and I hear somebody go, oh my God, Mohale Mashego, forget it's not my real name. Pull my bag into that Woolies, and then I say, hi, I'm so bad with names and faces, and I always tell them I'm often drunk. It's a good excuse. And then she says, oh, I know you from your book. You did not holler my name from where I was to tell me I know you from your book. And then I shook her hand and she was like, it's so lovely to meet you. And I walked away. I was like, anytime somebody shouts Mohale Mashego, I'm just going to keep walking because it's not even my real name. But that's how tired I was. I went to a complete stranger and I was like, I'm often drunk.
I mean, you mentioned a lot of the sort of stress and anxiety that you felt with your first book.
Yeah.
And then this book was super successful and everybody loved it and we all stalked you post reading this book, guys, because we all had questions. We still have questions.
You know we deserve those answers.
You're not going to get the answers.
But it's fine. I can't talk, y'all. now you write the second book, and you've had all of this acclaim and this critical acclaim. This book's won prizes. Everybody's just crazy over the book. You now write a second book. How did that change the way that you approached writing the second book?
I'd started writing these stories while I was working on The Yearning. So I'm often working on like two stories at a time. I don't know if it's like a concentration problem, but I just feel I work better if I'm working on two stories. So when I started writing some of these stories, I had not become the person that people call at an airport or any of that madness. So I felt no pressure. Although my publisher said, I know you're probably scared because, you know, critical acclaim or whatever. And I said, actually, I'm scared because I don't think people are ready for what I'm writing.
Okay.
Why did you feel that people weren't ready for what you were writing?
Because speculative fiction is always about a special boy whose father or grandfather died, hire Peter Parker. And, you know, he gets bitten by a radioactive spider. And this stuff is always for other people, but it's never for people like us. So, you know, a mermaid from Soweto, a werewolf from Mitchell's Plain who falls in love with a vampire from Limpopo. And I was just like, I think I've gone too far, and maybe we should save it for later. But she read the stories. And I'm such a lazy writer. I sent her four stories. And then she's like, okay, where's the rest? Then I sent her another two. Then she's like, no, but where's everything? And once she'd read everything, she said it would be crazy not to publish this.
I mean, I think before starting, and you did this when there was a reprint of The Yearning, you wrote like a little essay, but you also wrote an author's note in the start of Intruders. Would it be, can we ask you to read the author's note?
Okay, then I came here to read. Kinahana rabua fela.
Go, you're here to do everything.
So,
for those of you who have your Bibles, and if you don't, we hope this will encourage you to buy your book after this because you have so much FOMO. Please turn to the author's notes. It's on page 7.
I was going to be, it's on page VII.
I knew that. I was like, one, two. I took a moment to be like, is it okay? I'm sure it's seven.
You can't take me anywhere. Okay, so the author's note says, this one is for a girl who always saves a boy who lived. For delicate and invisible boys, lost souls with praying mothers, even a heathen like me has a praying mother. Those who raise themselves in a world that doesn't care whether they live or die. The progeny of forgotten legends. Those who've lost too much and have nothing but themselves. For young love and heartbreak and old heartbreak. The ones who fall asleep with a man and wake up next to a monster. For monster slayers and makers. For those who were spat out onto the streets. For the weird, the wonderful. And us, who never see ourselves in the stars, but die in seas searching for them. You are everything.
Okay, my sister. So why did you feel it was necessary for you to start these collection of short stories with an author's note?
So I've just been thinking about what a horror story South Africa is. I mean, if people were watching, if this was a movie, everybody in the cinema would be going, why is no one running? Why is no one trying to get rid of the zombies? You know, so the horror of living in South Africa for me made me realize that there are people who are invisible. And I wanted to let them know that I wrote this book for them and about them. That's why it's called Intruders. Because we are intruding on what they call speculative fiction. We are intruding on being in the background. So we are, you know, we are the protagonist. And I think I also wrote it for myself because I was going through a bad time. And I needed people like me and people who are forgotten or invisible to know that you are everything and you are seen. Even when you don't feel seen, we see you.
So prior to this, you have been working on Kwezi. Right? And Kwezi, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's just this amazing, I don't want to say cartoons?
Comics.
Comics.
Comic book.
It's a comic book.
It's a cool. comic books, right? And it's just been really interesting because we previously hadn't had anything like Kwezi, right? And I'm just curious how writing Kwezi and having that previous experience then influenced the ways in which you wrote this book.
Oh, I said I'd never say it again, but he's not here, so he won't hear me. Lois Mkhize always says, it doesn't matter what you're creating, it's the energy behind it. And believe it or not, the person who is going to receive the art, is going to see it, is going to read it, understands the energy. So all of my feelings about, you know, being so afraid that it may be too soon to have a book like this went away when I thought about it. But also, writing Kwezi has made me a little braver in where I take the story. You know, I'm just like, come on. Like, we draw, there's a guy in Kwezi who's a mayor, but he's a bad guy and he turns into a hyena. And if I can tell that story, then I feel brave enough to tell these ones as well.
And so there was the first African Comic Con happening a few weeks ago, and you were there. And how was that?
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
It was great because I didn't get nerd flu. So if you ever go to a con, people shake your hand and they've been holding their books forever and then they hand them over to you to sign and then you go home and you have nerd flu for a week. And there were 35,000 people there and people handling me the whole time and touching my face as well. So besides that, it was wonderful. I didn't get nerd flu. But also I realized that I am currently one of the only black women who's working on a commercial comic book. And that was really sad because on all the panels, it was just me. And I was like, I guess I'm an intruder. And now I want to train another black woman to take over from when I leave Kwezi so that there's more of us. There's got to be more of us doing this fun stuff, man. Not every time a doctor, but we need doctors.
On the morning that you are late because of my doctor, I collect my drag.
So for me, I think Alma and I were having a conversation, you know, throughout reading the book and preparing for the podcast about how, I mean, Lauren Bucas also describes it as subversive and electric and achingly familiar. And I describe it as hauntingly familiar, right? For me, it was hauntingly familiar because these are some of the stories that I grew up with, right? Some of the, let's call them urgent legends, right? And I think it's important what you say about, like, people who see you who look like you. So for me, that was what was important. The important part was seeing myself in these speculative fiction, right? But I also want to say that I think more than a work of fiction, this is an academic work, right? So you start, it really is, and we'll get into that. You start the book by talking about Mercy Pakena, right? And you're saying perhaps she was a philosopher because when she was talking about Ayachisa Madeki, this is not my size, perhaps she was talking about this idea. And you link this idea to what we've come to know as Afrofuturism, right? So we wanted to spend a bit of more time talking about Afrofuturism and what Afrofuturism, why you wanted to start Intruders by talking about Afrofuturism first.
Oh, yesterday I was on Azania's show and I said something and now the cool kids are going to hate me.
Hi.
I'm saying hi to Ngati. He's like, why is she waving at me? Okay, so do you have that definition in the... So Mark Derry, funny enough, he's a white man, and he was writing, this is what's so funny about this, he's a white man who was writing about science fiction, and the story, the essay is called Black to the Future. And he spoke to three people who were actually writing speculative fiction, or what was then called sci-fi. And he said speculative fiction that addresses African-American themes and addresses African-American concerns in the context of 20th century technoculture and more generally African-American signification that appropriates images of technology and a prosthetically enhanced future might want, for a better term, be called Afrofuturism. And that's great, but we've been having, being a majority, so I don't have those kind of representation issues. And I think Afrofuturism is very important. So Mark Derry talks about how Afrofuturism... Okay, so Afrofuturism is important for African-Americans who are always a minority in their country and have to imagine a black future, which is what often happens in a lot of Afrofuturism. And also they're in control of the technology because of the technology that was used, you know, on them in slavery, all of that kind of, you know, horrible stuff. But then I thought about it for a while and I was like, we're such culture vultures. We want everything. We want everything.
You call it cultural imperialism?
Cultural imperialism. And we are. We're culture vultures. Anything that comes from, you know, either the UK or the US, we're on it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can hear guys calling each other brav and talking about paying sneakers and all of that. And I was like, at some point, we're going to have to take a minute and think about, is Afrofuturism for us? Mm-hmm. And it's not. And I'll tell you why it's not. Because our experiences are so different as Africans living in Africa that I can't dream of a world full of black people because, hello, all around me. But also, I don't like the idea of just dreaming of the future and not, you know, dreaming of a fantastical now. So I leave there's a line there that's left in there, and I'm saying you can call it whatever you want to call it, but don't call it Afrofuturism, because then you're just parroting something that doesn't belong to you. And I think this is a good time for us to start, you know, really breaking down the things that we just take wholesale. And I'm not saying the diaspora doesn't deserve Afrofuturism. They do. There are people who write it really well. I just think it would be a joke if we just took Afrofuturism as a whole thing. Also, I said, when I saw pictures of people at this is the one that I shouldn't have said on Azania's show, but I said it now. When I saw pics of the people at Afropunk in Joburg, all it looked like was they were cosplaying someone who was cosplaying them. And when you have a culture, you don't need to cosplay what somebody who doesn't or who is desperate for it to have a culture. You don't cosplay that. You've had your culture your whole life. You've lived around black people your whole life. So even when they're like, oh, so much blackness, I'm like, are you joking? Like, is this an actual joke? So I did say that I saw a lot of people at Afropunk who were cosplaying somebody cosplaying them. And we need to start interrogating the things that we take wholesale from the States and the UK, because not all of it is for us. And that's going to make me unpopular again. Now I'm afraid to go to young people's spaces, because I'm afraid somebody's going to slap me for saying they were cosplaying someone who was cosplaying them.
So, a lot of the stories here, like Lachlan was saying, are kind of rooted in urban legend. Like, I know the story of the Veros, for example, right? And if you haven't really heard the story of the Veros, right, it's about these woman that she encounters always on a highway. Like, that was the story. It's always on a highway. Someone will get into your car and then they'll be like, please drop me off at some destination. And then you'll wake up at their gravesites or something equally as salacious, right? But you never just wake up in your car, because that's boring. Mm-hmm. You always land up at the gravesites or in somebody's house, and then you'll be like, oh no, I came with Mohale. And they're like, no, but Mohale died 20 years ago. What do you mean? And I found it really, it was for both of us, it was really interesting. It was really cool to find that she used a lot of childhood urban legends that we could relate to in writing these stories. And so we just wanted to know, I mean, you could have written completely different stories that had nothing to do with really anything that any of us could relate to, but why did you choose to use those very particular contextual stories to write?
Because we've been having speculative fiction. We just didn't know the Vera's, the horse without a head, but that can save Lotus Makeoff. Like, how is the horse talking if it doesn't have a head? We didn't question any of that. So we've been having speculative fiction, and I just wanted to turn it up a notch. And also, I'm convinced the Vera story was just a bunch of wives who were like, why are you driving at night? You're going to wake up in a gravesite. Stay home. Where are you going? You know, trying to keep their husbands and sons home. But I do feel like we've been having speculative fiction. We've been having it, as they say. So for me, it was just, how do I take something that we know and turn it up a notch or take it in a different direction?
Speaking of a different direction, there's a lot of social commentary in the book that Tlhokomelo and I found. So with the Veras, right? You talk about how it's a collection of spirits of women who have been murdered by men, right? And they're then emboldened by like an event that happens. And we were talking about just in the past year how much we've heard about femicide in this country, and it's an interesting social commentary. Imagine if all of the women in this country who have been murdered by men were to actually rise up, for example, like the Veras, what would that look like?
There would be so few men in this country, we'd have to import them in from other. We have to call Nigeria. Do you perhaps have 20,000 men for us, because ours are dead? I didn't know about the social commentary bit until I finished reading this thing, and I realized that I wrote a lot of these stories when I was depressed about being a South African living in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And you don't know the person behind the headline, man. Mm-hmm. You always hear a woman something bad, mm-hmm. and it's not even on the front page because it's so common. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to take an urban legend like Vera and turn it up a notch, because I'm so tired of hearing about women being killed by their intimate partners, mm-hmm. or yet by a stranger. Just mm-hmm. walk up to a woman and be like, okay, I'm here to kill you, mm-hmm. you know. And I when I say it like that, it sounds terrible. But I was just tired of it, and I thought, what would happen if Vera wasn't just one ghost that was keeping men from driving at night to go and see their sides? And and it actually became something that was terrible, you know, because I'm so tired of hearing about women dying in South Africa. So when I wrote that, I was exhausted about the horror of living in this country and how okay we are with living in a horror story.
And I think also linked to that is the idea of this futuristic, right? So it's imagining this future. And it appears that a lot of the story imagine a future where women are the protagonists of their own lives, right? So the men in most of these stories are already peripheral. Was that intentional?
Yes. Because, I'm going to forget, is it Star Trek Voyager, the one with the black woman, Michael somebody? Anyway, it was such a big deal. Mm. It was such a big deal that on this spaceship that's been gone all over, even collected Klingons, it was unbelievable that a black woman was going to save the day. And I was so exhausted with us applauding people for doing silly things like that I thought, you know what, I'm just going to put a bunch of badass black women. The one woman kills a man in a taxi rank with her high heel, the high heel killer,
yes, queen.
You know, one ends up in space. Just I think women in South Africa deserve to know that we see you, and we know that you're saving the day every day. And you're the glue that's holding this horror story together. Because really, if one day we decided we're done and we moved to Nigeria, because they're nice men in Nigeria, men over here would have to call a country that would not take their calls. They'd be like, oh, South Africa, you need women. Sorry, ribbies. You know? Sorry, South Africa. So I think I wanted women to know that they can be the badass. It's not just Peter Parker. It's not just Tony Stark. You know, it's...
Not Superman.
Yeah. Now you leave Superman alone. Oh, wow. He's an alien. Leave him out of this.
But also connected to that, it seems in this futuristic world, there's still like a lot of social ills that are happening, right? So we don't completely reimagine a new world, right? Mm-hmm. So, so the one story that... Well, most of the stories also seems that there's still violence and patriarchy is still there, right? But the one story, the spaceship story, there seems to be a lot of class distinction. So even in this new world, people are still... Like, so let's call it a world outside of whiteness. Even the world outside of whiteness still has tinges of whiteness and still has tinges of class. Was that also deliberate?
I kept on thinking about Elon Musk. What a... There's a kid here, so I'm going to use a kid-friendly word. What a poopy face. I hope that's a word you use, Nana. Otherwise, you just learned a new word. Poopy face. But... And I kept thinking about all of the people who can afford to be in a spaceship should this ball finally get tired of us and go, okay, today's the last day. All of those people... are people who are not in the same class as us. They're probably not even black people. I mean, Oprah will definitely be there. I want the Oprah spaceship. But the spaceship themselves, you don't go into space and then suddenly forget racism and classism and sexism because, you know, the world has blown up. So in this particular story where one of the sisters does end up in space, it becomes very obvious who built the spaceship and who it was made for. And the fact that, you know, you still have to do some work. It's like, oh no, you can be here. And then all of a sudden, you don't have access to the nice library because you're not doing the work. You know, because you're in cabin X, whatever. I can't remember what I call these cabins. But, I mean... racism, sexism, the patriarchy, homophobia, all of the phobias don't go away because we're in space. And they won't go away because in space, because the people who can afford to actually put us on ships are poopy faces.
So spirituality comes up in the book in different ways, right? I mean, the story of... It's like Little Red Riding Hood right at the end. But
Tselane.
Tselane, like, yeah. And Manuka as well, who's just my favorite. But it comes up often, right? And I think that it's sort of like a theme that weaves throughout your books, because The Yearning was also quite... Ruby had like a spiritual thing going on in The Yearning. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be like a continuing spiritual theme even in that. Like, even in this Afro-futuristic world that we're trying to reimagine, spirituality comes up quite often, and I find it really interesting because of how you often describe yourself as a heathen and you know you do, girl.
I come from a very spiritual family. On my mother's side, there's you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who is not Isangoma or like a priest or a prophet or whatever. So growing up around really spiritual people was interesting for me because I'd always listen to what they were saying. And I mean, yes, I'm a heathen. I think maybe let's say atheist. God, why did I write heathen? What a bad word.
Right.
In the second edition, I'm going to have to write atheist as is. Heathen is such a strong word. But I grew up around very spiritual people from my mom's side of the family. And I didn't think it affected me until I saw it come through in my writing. And it's, you know, spirituality has got so much power in people's lives, regardless of whether you believe in a god or ancestors or whatever. It's got a lot of power, and it's got a place. It's got a place. And you know, black people love church. So, you know, I had to say something about somebody's grandmother going to love church. So I had to say something about somebody's grandmother going to church. But it was important to me once I realized how it was a theme that was coming through. Mm-hmm. And I never want to separate who I am now, a heathen, to, you know, from who I was. Mm-hmm. And I was a child who grew up around really spiritual people.
So there's an untitled story which it takes part in three parts, right? And obviously there's a novel there, right? Because we deserve one.
You know, it's called Untitled 1, 2, 3, and then the book ends. Why Ubata 4, 5, 6, 7?
That's because like,
that's not how short stories work.
Well, you see, that is the thing,
that's
right?
Another thing
you were like,
1, story.
2, 3. And I was like, but wait.
Is 4, 5, 6.
There must be more chapters to Kamo and Bonola. I want to know what's happening in Out of Space and here in the Joburg, but not Joburg.
I know, in post-apocalyptic South Africa. Why did you... Somebody from my publishers here now, and don't snitch, Eileen. But I'm already working on Untitled.
Because I
feel like these girls deserve more time than I gave them. They were actually just like a little break from the heaviness of, you know, the other stories.
I don't know if they were a break, Mohale, because wow, those girls go through it, right? It's like, they go through it in the book. It's really interesting that you think they were a break. I think they were some of the heavier characters in the story, because you develop an attachment to them. So it's siblings. Like, I can think of my brother and I interacting that way. I can think of my brother, for example, wanting me to get onto the spaceship and get rescued, and him staying behind. Like, those are relationships that you can think of. It's not, you left your sibling behind post-apocalyptic Joburg.
These things happen. Not every time taking your brother and sister. But no, I thought I loved Untitled because I thought it's such a break from all of the murder and, you know, the ghosts and the horror. And I thought, what a very nice break. But
this
apparently
is why we were attached to them, right? Like, because we just want to know what happens to these girls. Like, and also because they're young, right? It's like, you can see your little cousin in them. You can see that they're young. They're these young girls who have no family to speak of. They just have each other. And then you separate them. Like, you're wrong for that.
So I just want you to read like a paragraph from Untitled 3.
Yes.
Can you start reading here from Bonolo Means? And then just
page,
ending
page.
It right here. So
for
those
of you
who have
Bibles,
164.
So where do you want me to start reading from?
Just hear from Bonolo until the end of this.
Okay. Bonolo means easy or uncomplicated, but nothing except her birth was easy for my sister. Mm. Bonolo was a child genius who got straight A's, went to university before her age mates, graduated, and never became the engineer she wanted to be. Instead, she grew tired of the job rejection letters and ended up working as a secretary for a GP. She'd also decided that being smart was a disadvantage, so she played small and unremarkable until she started to believe it.
And that really has stayed with me, right? Because I think that it's a lot of social commentary that speaks a lot about like what we as particularly black and brown people go through in this country, right? So you've got this, I read a thread the other day of this person saying, you know, they studied at UCT, they went to Oxford, but they spent about 2 years looking for a job, right? And this idea that, like Bonolo, get an education, go to university, and everything will be fine. But everything is not going to be fine.
No.
Because, like, the construction of corporate South Africa in this country is still white, right? So you can be as excellent a black person as ever, but if you don't have the connections and if you can't get in, you can't get in. No UCT degree or Oxford degree is going to get you in. So I wanted to know, in your breaking, you were touching on really, like, intense social commentary about, like, what structural inequality looks like for black people in this country.
But also for me, he must use his UCLA English. But also it was to add on to that, it was a commentary on black excellence. I think we're having real conversations about black excellence right now, and the ways in which black excellence also serves as a barrier for other black people, right? So barriers of entry. Like, but the idea that black people are constantly held to a standard of excellence that doesn't apply for anybody else. So before you can even get a foot in the door, you need to be excellent in ways in which other people are allowed to be mediocre. Kwanzaa. I mean, had Bonolo been a young white girl, she'd be flourishing. Like, who would be sending her rejection letters, you know? And the idea that black women's lives and black women's dreams are always a story of, like, a dream deferred, a dream I had to put aside because I have a younger sister I misraised, or because there's this world that just cannot fathom the idea of black women wanting to be anything outside of what they've decided we must be, was such an interesting commentary to make in this particular section of the book.
Well, in that one paragraph, guys, we got all of this. I'm so smart.
Yes!
No, but you see, in a short story, there's no time to, like, tell the story of the rejection letters, because a short story is like CrossFit. I keep saying, you know, in CrossFit you go until you vomit, apparently, which is why I'm not going to go to CrossFit, because why are we exercising till we vomit? And writing a novel is like practicing for a marathon, and you have time. And in this one story, I just wanted to show that Bonolo is not, she's not done. And she's like a lot of people who are sitting at home without a job. Mm. They have the degrees, and they're very, very smart, but they're sitting at home or even taking jobs of being a GP's secretary or receptionist, because there's nothing else to do, so you do what you have to do. And I think this story, Untitled, for me was they were both doing what they had to do, even when she sent Bonolo away.
And so for me, what's been really interesting is how openly you speak about mental health, right? And this happened when you were writing The Yearning, but even more prominently now, right? And why do you think it's important for you as, or why do you think it's important for Mohale?
Thank you.
For Mohale to speak about mental health. And I'm asking this particularly in light of what we know what happened at UCT with Professor Mayosi, that people think when you have these awards and these accolades that everything is hanky-dory. So why do you think it's important for you to speak so openly about mental health?
Because there's a lot of shame, and I wish I could say I have no shame when I think about some of my mental illnesses, but there's a lot of shame, and I just want somebody to be like, well, if that crazy drunk auntie on Twitter can talk about, you know, the fact that she's having a bad day, she's feeling anxiety or she's depressed, then maybe they can tell someone. Because the thing about mental illness is it's so isolating. It's so isolating because if you try to explain to somebody, I cannot go to the shop, I cannot leave the house, somebody is probably going to be like, it's because it's lazy, you know, you're just lazy. And also trying to explain the emptiness of depression is exhausting in itself. And I talk about it because I want people to know that it's okay to not be okay.
So the book is divided into three parts, the good, the bad, and the colorful.
I just want to say I didn't see the good. Yeah. I was just like, is this the good? Where is the good?
I was like, ghost ring. Where is the goodness in a ghost
ring? Wow. This is the sound of Mahan walking away.
I am so curious as to, firstly, how?
How is this the good thing?
And so the division, why did you...
You don't see positivity. You're always just thinking negative. Now let me see. The good, Manuka, first of all, she finally discovers who she is. Yeah. She was an outsider.
Well, so I saw the good there. The good there. When she flows into the ocean.
Doesn't Dumiso's family agree with the goodness of her finances?
Listen, his family is not important. Not important in this story. Go strain in is, do you know when men know that their friend is rubbish? And they carry them around their whole lives. And they even give you a warning. They're like, my friend's a little weird, which means he's like predatory. And they carry them around. And this time, this boy carried around his friend who was a zombie because they found each other. And I wanted to tell a story about like tender boys who aren't necessarily the best kids, hey? They're not. They train surf. They do dumb stuff. They do poopy face stuff. And... Oh, is the baby sleeping?
Mm-hmm.
They do poopy face stuff, but they found each other. Mm. And the good for me was the male friendship and the fact that he carried his zombie friend in a coffin around because he believed that there would be a cure one day. Dear good.
No, so this is what I was talking to Alma. I was talking about, especially Ghost Train, right? It speaks, it's a deliberate attempt to speak about like male intimacy, right?
Yeah.
And how the softness of and tenderness of males that we don't speak about. Because it's always this narrative of obuchu in or strong or masculine, you are the one. But eventually the good. But I'm just saying these stories were not the good. I thought really people are gonna fall in love. It's gonna be amazing.
And first of all, Manuka fell in love, and these two love each other so much that the one is carrying his friend in a coffin in the zombie apocalypse.
But it's also very humanizing. I mean, so you think of those. I thought of the way you portrayed the strain. You know, like it started off as a strain in a certain part of the. I don't want to give away too much. I give people must buy the book.
Then I tell the stories.
It started off as a strain in one part of the city, and then moved on to more affluent parts of the city. And often when you think about these boys, like you'll hear people throw terms like "ha abonya upe boy" around, you know, but there's no sort of understanding of the humanity behind that, right? No one ever thinks, it's, oh, you know, this was a person that had a mother or a sister who loved him, that there's a person behind the addiction or behind the substance use. And for me, this really humanized them. It was a little bit creepy that he walked around with his friend.
But that's what men do. They carry their dead friends around instead of saying, hey, dude, you need to change your life or go. Yeah. No, they will literally carry them around in coffins forever and ever. Okay, the Palermo, I'm trying to think why I said it was good. Oh, it's good because it talks a lot about gentrification.
Yes.
And the fact that we forgive men. So it's like a man will do a really bad thing to you. And then 2 weeks later, hi, bae. When is that vacation? So for me, it was about the goodness of memories and how important it is to remember. And to keep remembering that, no, this guy, when the other bad, like he was bad from day one, just because now we're going on vacation to Mauritius. You know,
that's cool.
And now, humanity. So for me, it was the importance, and what makes it good is that it's also about the city, the inner, you know, the CBD, about how horrific this place is and how filled with blood it is and how people are trying to renew it, but how good the goodness of memories. When you try to renew a place, don't ever forget what was happening and erase it. So it was about the goodness of memories. Oh, an untitled one. Well, that was just good because a sister saved her sister's life. So that's all the... It was good. You're so negative.
You're
so negative.
I hear you, like, you know, you must be really optimistic, but some of these stories are like, I was like, this is the good, what is the bad? Yeah. Like, if this is the good, what is the bad? The colorful I could see. The colorful I really could see. But I think, like, in all, your sophomore collection.
Yes. Yes.
It's actually something that we need, and I had said earlier that it's academic, and I was saying this because I think that we're starting to reimagine ourselves as an Africa, living in Africa as black people, and these stories are something that we can draw back into and say, okay, what does it look like for black people living in Africa, thinking futuristically, speculative? Because I also think, although it's speculative fictions, there are a lot of social commentaries that aren't speculative. We know people are dying out here. And I think that we're going to use this to start thinking about looking at bubblegum music. You know, I was thinking about Born to Kwaito, which is sort of bringing our stories into the fora of the academy.
So I think we're so bad at archiving and just, you know, looking at the culture that we're creating that... 10 years from now, some Swedish guy is going to come and he's going to be like, this interesting thing happened in South Africa and I'm going to write about it. Because we don't document and we don't archive.
Yeah. And also, I mean, reading this and then being able to relate to so many, because you always used to hear about like Abo Vater Messi. I know, y'all know those stories.
Varus Mekop. I'm still haunted by Varus Mekop.
But how is the horse talking if it doesn't have a head? We were so dumb and scared. We were like, how is the horse? We didn't ask.
Scary thing, right?
right?
Yes. Than a horse without a head.
I was thinking Pinky.
We were all scared of Pinky Pinky. I didn't even know what she was scared of, but she was scared of Pinky Pinky.
We were just scared.
You can't go. I remember in primary school, you didn't go to the toilet by yourself. You called a friend because Pinky Pinky is going to deal with you if you go by yourself. Listen. And then you watch Harry Potter and you see Moaning Myrtle, and I'm like, well, Pinky Pinky. So I just put it in a nice movie and flourish. Like, did you watch that and was like, this is Pinky
but
Pinky?
But also, guys. Like, I was thinking about this when I was reading the story about the telling of our stories, right? So, like, when you watch these speculative fiction, Harry Potter, Star Trek, you're like, hey, Matt. People have been talking about this, like, in our communities, but we just haven't been creating. So, right? So who has the ownership to tell our stories? And I think that Intruders is starting to have this conversation that actually there are urban legends that we aren't talking about. We aren't talking about... I was reading an article about Ubuntu as an Afrofuturism concept, right? So someone was
like
talking... And I was like, maybe we should talk about this offline because, you know, some people might want to sponsor us. So
let's talk about it offline because I have a lot to say about that.
But it also speaks to the idea that these stories are not outside of us, right? That this idea of we don't always have to... And Kalaga Putuma says it's so beautiful. How come when people want to hear about black children's childhood, you never want to hear about the joy? You never want to hear about the creative things that were happening in black people's childhoods, right? Like, Pinky Pinky's creative, whoever sold us Pinky Pinky did an amazing job because a whole couple of generations of school children were afraid of going to the bathroom, right?
It was the teacher. She was like, they go to the toilet all the time, so I'm going to create a ghost.
That is resourcefulness right there, right? That you want your kids. But it's also the idea that we are beginning to... Somebody asked me a question at the SA Book Fair, and I just... They said, do you think that there's been a development since in the writing of black writers? And then this person talked about Eskia Mphahlele and Ken Temba. I'm like, but that, when did Eskia Mphahlele and Ken Temba write? To use that as the standard of saying that black writers have not developed their identities. And I thought,
who is this person?
Okay, guys, let's not...
But I mean, it speaks to that.
Basically, anyone listening, we just need more money, you know, to have more podcasts.
Because with this book, I was thinking about that. With this book, 20 years ago, have had the kind of markets and the kind of audience that it does now. Like, everybody is reading The Intruders. You go on social media, you go on Twitter, we're all uploading our books, like, yes, queen, you know?
Yes, it's a bestseller, hurry up!
I think the other question we'd like to know, obviously it would be remiss for us as a literary podcast to not ask, like, let's not go in your life. Let's just say, in 2018, right, what are some of the books that had you, you know, taken aback? For us personally, one of the books, the best books we've read this year, is The Ones with Purpose by Nosy Zojele. Yo! That book is just like, yeah. But also, obviously, Intruders is on the list! It is there!
It's the only one on the list, actually.
So what are some of the books that have really had you, you know, taken aback in 2018 particularly? Because black women have been releasing this year.
I think this thing happens to me after I publish a book, I lose my words. So I can't read, I can't write. So I watch a show called Nailed It on Netflix. Really, these people cannot bake and they're the worst. And afterwards they have to show these monstrosity and go, Nailed It! So I've been watching Nailed It and a lot of Come Dine With Me and a lot of my, what is it called? My 600-pound life. So I've lost my words. So I haven't been able to read. But the books that I have read that I thought were really beautiful is a book by Mariana. Oh, I'm going to forget her surname. Yeah, just Google there. But it's called Things We Lost in the Fire.
Yes.
And I met her, and she's so blasé. She's like, I was trying to do something, and I don't know if I did it well, but at least I'm giving permission to other writers to write about this. She is so, like, sexy creepy. Like, you just... You know, there's a story about a child being beheaded in, I think it's like the first story. And I was like, this is so good. This is so good. Not because of the child, but because she handles She handles, and this is another book I can't finish because I've lost my words. So I'm literally reading two pages at a time. And I read another book by Leslie Neka Arima called What Happens When a Man Falls from the Sky. And it was, before I started reading Things We Lost in the Fire, it was one of the best books I'd read this year, and I was gifting it to books. Marcia, give Mariana Mang.
Enrique?
Oh, thank you. You see, I should have just said Enrique Iglesias. I would have gotten it. So,
thank you.
Mariana Enrique is just, she's so normal that when you read her books, you're like, hey, something is happening in her mind. Mm. But those are the two books that I've been able to read and actually finish. Also because it was part of my open book reading list. So I had to finish them. And I'm trying to think what else was on my open book. I also had to read Tlomo the Wife. But I had to read the whole series. And that took up quite a lot of time. So I think those books are the ones that I have been able to read. But now I've lost my words and I'm reading two pages like a week. And this always happens after a book gets published. I feel like I was immersed in words and now I don't know how to enjoy them properly. So I give myself time. So ask me this in 2 months.
Okay. So what's next for you, Mahali?
Bonolo and Kamu next year.
Next year, this time.
Wow, you know, guys, I actually have to sit down and write these stories.
Remember, we gave you land last time.
Don't snitch.
Use the land we gave you last time for the yearning to go write this. Remember?
Ikai land. You guys didn't give me the keys to the land, so I can't even go to my nice farm and sit on those outside, you know, those ugly outside chairs everybody has at a braai, and sit on one of those ugly outside braai chairs and write. I'm waiting for my land.
Stay tuned.
What's next is there is a book I started writing, and I don't like to give the name because then the name will change. But it's a book I started writing before I finished The Yearning, and that's when Marcia said to me, how you do one thing is how you do everything. And if you can't finish The Yearning, you won't be able to finish this one. So I've been working on it for a while, and I think that will be not next year, but the year after.
Do you know what's super interesting about hearing Mahali talk about the books that she's writing or the stuff she's working on is how it took you 10 years to
write I know!
To write The Yearning, and now every 2 years she publishes a book. Do you feel dragged?
I am so dragged. Whiling dragger. I thought this was about celebrating me, but the brief was wrong. I'm leaving. No, but The Yearning took me so long because I didn't think I could be a writer. And even when I finished it, I sent it to Zakes after Marcia was like, send it to Zakes.
For the listeners, Zakes and Da is her best friend.
Yes, he's my BFF. And I sent it to Zakes and he said, I didn't know you were a writer. So I said, come on, you're an award-winning writer. I bet every second person you meet is like, I have this story. How can I write it? Or I'm a writer for sure. Just like inspire me. So, you know, and we were friends as well. And I felt like I was taking advantage of our friendship. But he read it and then he said, you know, go get it published. And you guys know the story. Mm-hmm. All the major publishers rejected it. One of them said, we already have a book like this in the works. Where is their bestseller? These lying ass guys. Where is their bestseller?
Anyway,
those are her personal views, not that of the chicken makers.
You're so dead at the casual pulling out of receipts, and you become that auntie.
I'm everyone's inappropriate aunt. This is all I've ever wanted in my life.
If everyone has that inappropriate aunt, you'll be at a family gathering. And it's great, you know, and someone does something and she pulls out the receipts and it's like she keeps them here in her breast pockets.
And I'm just hold on, I've got receipts. Even then last year, you loaned 5,000 igai, but you've got a nice handbag. Anyway, I have been waiting my whole life to be an inappropriate aunt. And now that my brother has 5 million children, I am their inappropriate aunt. But I'm also the inappropriate aunt of people on, you know, on Twitter as well. So But it was rejected. So I was going to self-publish, and I found a publisher. I found an editor, and she said to me, I'll take your money, but I really think you should give this to a major publisher. And I was like, what do you think I was doing before this baby? I was just sitting at home waiting for an editor. She gave me two emails, and to prove a point to her, I only emailed one person, and that person is now my publisher, Andrea, who is the best. She is the reason why Intruders happened, because I was looking for a place where I could post free stories, and then Lauren Pierkes was like, no, that's not what we do. We don't give our word babies away for free, so no. And my publisher, who's a stalker, she was like, I saw what you and Lauren were talking about, send me some, I just want to see if it's something we can publish. I was like, already, babes. So the reason Intruders happened is because Andrea believes in me, and it's so nice to have a publisher that believes in you. And all the guys at Pan, and I'm not saying this because
Balab,
some are here, but they're all very, very supportive, and they know when I'm having my mental breakdowns. They talk to my boss, Marcia, and they make her do things or force me to do things. So it's nice. It's nice to be published. It's nice to be a writer, but it's also poopy face work.
So I like to read the acknowledgements in your books, because you know I have a best friend whose interest I must look out for, and I really like the last line of the acknowledgement.
For those of you who have your Bibles, give last page.
182. Lastly, I would like to thank my dearest Marcia for carrying my heart with her. And you know what? As the Cheeky Natives, we think that at some point we must give Marcia land. Because Marcia is the reason why
we
had the yearning. Now we have Intruders. And next year or 2 years from now, we'll have another book and another book and another book. Because Marcia is really like, she, you know, the boss we deserve.
She is the reason I'm alive. And I'm not saying that lightly. She's the reason why I'm alive, because I was a depressed little suicidal person, and she took me and she gathered me, and she does carry my heart. Sometimes it's okay to live without your heart for a while so you can get through the world, and my heart is in a safe place.
So we have to give Mahalo.
She's crying. Marcia is crying for those of you who aren't here. She's crying like a fool.
But I love your friendship with Marcia, because I think all the good and beautiful relationships you see between women in your stories come from that relationship with Marcia. Like Unatsia, guys, everyone knows how I feel about Unatsia and Marubini. But even here, Bunolo and Kamu, I think often all the and we don't give enough credence to beautiful friendships between women. I think a lot of the time we think that women have the kind of friendships that are competitive. You know, most women are not allowed to dislike each other. So
I dislike so many women.
So we never really give credence. We're in a world that really places a lot of emphasis on romantic relationships and grooms women to place those kind of relationships above every kind of relationship that exists. And it's always so beautiful to see black women outside of Gail and Oprah just love each other publicly and in ways that are so good and so true and reflect in really good ways for how they live their lives.
So thank you, Marcia.
But thanks, Marcia, when is the Oprah money coming? Because you know I'm Gail. You know I'm Gail, and there's no money in books. Bestseller, guys. Bestseller. So I can get nice royalties. So please, can you make your Oprah money quickly? No pressure.
No, but she's the Oprah. I don't understand.
Let's just open it up for like 5 minutes, maybe for one or two questions, and then
we have to move on the line. Okay, Mohale Mashiko, now is the time for you to ask.
If you have,
we might not be in the presence of such greatness again for free.
Any questions?
Go to any wine bar and you will find me there. They are lying.
My name is Amir. I just love to ask, I think the story you told about trying to get your work published and going from publishing books to publishing house and this anonymous type email address, so everyone else is available. It's a common story for many writers. It seems to be a highly network-based kind of environment. What do you think needs to change in that space for more stories and more writers who have good quality stories to tell to to get discovered and to be celebrated and to have their work consumed.
So I wrote an essay for this supplement, yeah, Mail and Guardian. It was about how sometimes, so I wouldn't have been published if it wasn't for my editor who gave me 2 email addresses and I only emailed 1 person to prove a point that people hate me. And then what happens is we need to start opening up the doors. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a trap door, sometimes get back door, but in my work as a writer, I always try to find another writer to say to the people who have the independent bookstores, this person has self-published, but it's a really good book. Can you just take 5 copies? And sometimes I find publishers who specialize in things and I say, this is a person you may want to talk to. Because if we don't do that, then what's the point? I never want to be the only one. I never ever want to be the only one. Even with Kwezi, so our team after issue 16, we're going to hand over to a team. And they already have people who work in illustration and coloring. And I don't have a black woman to train. So if you guys know of a black woman who would love to be in comics, so that next year at Comic-Con, it's me and her. And the next year, it's me and her and somebody else. If you're the only one, then you've done it wrong. Mm.
Any
so
other
that's
questions?
What I do. Sure. That's a quotable.
Any other questions?
Okay. Don't be shy, guys.
All right. Mohale.
I know somebody wants to ask a question. I just know. I can feel it. Mm. And I don't know if it's because I've drank too much water.
You have a question. No?
I'm just checking. Don't be shy. And then when I'm signing your book, you're telling me your life story when you had a chance there to have it on the podcast.
Wow.
So
I'm kidding.
Mohale, we... You know, we are a huge fan of your work. Since The Yearning, now Intruders, and we will continue to continue. We are the originals.
We have first edition copies. I just want to put it out there.
But we want to thank you also for this speculative fiction, but what I would say an academic piece of work. Thank you for writing us back into history. I think that a lot of the works of black writers, contemporary black writers, is doing the work of not only archiving but rewriting our stories, right? So we know writers like Miriam Gladdy, who is said to be the first black woman to publish in English, right? Her books are not available anymore, but how can we read them?
I paid so much money for a secondhand copy that's falling apart from the States. I'm ashamed to say how much I paid. Bati, it's because it's not in print, right? Because then I wouldn't have to be ashamed of how much money I paid for a secondhand copy that looks like somebody dunked it in water. Anyway, you know, that's an Amazon issue, not a Cheeky Natives issue. Please continue.
So thank you. Just thank you for starting to do this important work of really writing our stories. So I find that young children 10 years from now can look back at this conversation but also read Intruders and be like, oh wow, like I didn't know this and now I do, right? Or even now when we still tell our children about Binky Binky and Virus Makeup, that they can start reading and listening to this. So thank you all for the important work that you do. Thank you, Marsha, for holding Mohale accountable, because we need more books.
Why accountable? You could have said for holding her heart like I said. Just get upset, accountable.
But just to also echo what Tokonole has said, I think that with every book that you've written, we can see ourselves in it. So, I mean, The Yearning, my mother and I fought over the ending of The Yearning, right? Because she had her own opinion. I was like, you're so wrong. I've had this woman on my podcast. Like, and then she's like, well, firstly, I taught you to read. So you can just take a few steps back and breathe. And then I read The Intruders. And I'm like, yes, I can relate. We all have an aunt, a cousin, somebody like this, right? And there's something so powerful about being able to see yourself in print or to see representations of yourself, right? Like, people always talk about representation but always make it seem like this cute thing that it means having one black person at the table.
Or middle class
black person who speaks well, and it's just like one of my best friends.
But feel like you're subbing us. What's happening here?
But there's something just so powerful about the fact that you continuously write these stories where we can look at ourselves and see who we hope to be over and over again, and just like constantly causing us to ask ourselves questions, right? It's like you can't have read The Intruders and not walked out and asked yourself what it means to reimagine a post-apocalypse Joburg. What does that mean for people who look like you, right? Because we always talk about reimagining the future, but what does it mean to reimagine the future? And these are personal questions that you ask of us over and over again, and you do it in such a great way that at the end of the book, you only realize afterwards, oh, actually, Mohana's asking me questions that I may not have the answers to yet. But also to thank you for continuously just being available. Like, on Twitter, I've seen people tweet you all the time and just be like, oh my God, they're yearning, Nana, and all these things. And you're just constantly available and constantly accessible. And it just makes it so much easier for the people who will come after you to feel like there are people who look like me, who had the struggles that I had, and then still were able to tell their stories with such bravery and courage. And so we just want to thank you from the Cheeky Natives.
Thanks, guys. I don't know what to say, but thank you very much.
Obviously, if you listen to the Cheeky Natives, this is the part where we give land. And the reason why we give land is because the land is coming. And we are the land committee. We will be handing out title deeds.
I get the feeling I'm not getting land this year.
Well, you still are, you know, the lush wine farm that you have in Stellenbosch. You're still enjoying yourself. So what we will do is that there's a farm next to it. We're also giving you that farm so that you can have a huge piece of land there in Franschhoek and enjoy yourself, right?
You know, you as a person who studied all of this law are making these promises more, and the people are getting so caught.
Are you going to see me?
Getting so caught. And, you know, milady, I was obviously so hurt when there was no farm, and I'm 60 now, milady. When can one expect a farm?
No, I hear this, sir, because you'll have your land. So when the land comes and you're sitting on that beautiful farm, and I can see you're doing, like, you know, the Oprah specials where Oprah interviews people on her farm and people come and visit her on her
No, the people are not going to know my address. So, no.
No. Guys, I did try.
So, where can people get a hold of you on the socials?
I thought you meant, what is my address? I was going to What did I just say to you?
On the social media.
On the socials, I'm terrible at Facebook, and Marcia's fixing that. Marcia's fixing my life. I'm usually on Twitter and Instagram. Sometimes I post my breasts, just giving you a heads up. I posted a dress and I was saying ready for braless season. And then Bob Rather in my DMs, hat, can't wait for summer. But it wasn't, there was no nip or nothing. It was, guys, it was like this. Oh, can't wait for summer, come to Lagos.
Well, that's actually Nigeria, right? She's bees talking about Nigeria.
Charles in Nigeria. I was like,
and the brother who hopped into her DMs from Lagos on Instagram. Please do the things, because wow, she's really in Lagos.
So I occasionally post my cleavage, no nip. You know, I'm trying to keep it clean because I write books and I have to inspire the children. But I'm Black Porcelain on Twitter and Instagram. And don't worry, there's not going to be any more things. Black Porcelain without an A, yes. So it's BLCK. But that thing is not there anymore. So don't worry.
So thank you very much for coming to the Cheeky Natives. Obviously, we know you'll be a resident guest here, because when another book is coming, we will welcome you with open arms.
And so much of land.
Always.
I can't wait to sue you. I'm so looking forward to it.
So again, thank you very much, Mohale Mashego, for writing our stories back into history. And thank you very much for being a supporter of the Cheeky Natives and the work that we're trying to do at the Cheeky Natives.
I think you guys are doing amazing work, because it's one thing to write a book where you want people to be seen, but for people to actually break down the books and, you know, have a gathering and actually talk like this, this is really cool, and I'm so glad to have been your first supporter.
Thank you. So you can obviously shout out to our favorite bookstore, Bridge Books. Mm-hmm. If you want to get a book at Bridge Books, you can get The Yearning and Intruders. You can just use Cheeky Voucher and get a 10% discount. Because you know we love people who buy books, so we want to give them a celebration of the books.
And we say this on every episode, but until you guys stop your foolery, we're not going to stop. Please stop asking authors for free books. It costs money to have books printed. Please stop asking for PDFs. Please stop borrowing your friend's copy to borrow another friend who's going to borrow the friend. Please buy a copy. Like, it is so important for us to buy books and to give platforms to black writers. We cannot hope to grow the canon of black literature if we don't support black writers. And we're doing this so that in 10 years' time, when someone who looks like Mohale wants to write and publish a book, the publisher is going to be like, oh, you know, I had such great success with the Mohale. How dare I not give you a chance? And we're doing this. We're doing this not just for the now, but for the future as well. Even for you, Mohale.
Bestseller.
This is us, the Chickenators, and Mohale signing out.
Bye.